Bry. Court is now in session. Please be seated.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Kenneth Nassar here on behalf of Appellees, USA Interactive, Sunny Sub, LLC. With the permission of the court, my colleague Paul Rowe of Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen, and Cass will be making the argument on behalf of Appellees. He has been admitted pro hoc vice.
Welcome, Mr. Rowe.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Candace Aaron of Richards, Layton, and Finger, here on behalf of Appellants, the Vivendi Parties. With me today is my co-counsel, Mr. James Quinn of Weil Gotshal. Mr. Quinn has been admitted pro hoc vice in this action, and with the court's permission, will be making Vivendi's presentation today.
Mr. Quinn.
Your Honor, with permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes. Thank you, Your Honor. As Your Honors know, this is an appeal from a judgment on the pleadings in which the Vice Chancellor effectively awarded plaintiff USA Interactive over $1 billion. And that award was made without any discovery. No documents were exchanged. No depositions were taken. It was done based on what we believe was premature fact-finding by the Vice Chancellor, in which the Vice Chancellor took the pleading and instead of, as we believe would be proper, taking inferences in favor of the non-movement, the Vivendi, actually inferred from the pleadings facts that were against the non-movement, the Vivendi. We believe that under Delaware Supreme Court, clear precedent was improper and was reversible error. Members of the court, all we really want here is our day in court, a chance to show a fact finder that, in fact, we are right with regard to what the parties intended and to what the actual agreement was between the parties. Below, we argue two independent grounds with regard to the contract. First, that the agreement is ambiguous, and secondly, that in any event, even if the court were to find no ambiguity, that nonetheless it resulted from mistake, whether unilateral or mutual. Members of the court, the contract simply does not reflect either the party's intentions or the actual agreement that the parties entered into with regard to tax distributions. In effect, what the Vice Chancellor did was looking at two what we believe to be reasonable interpretations of this contract, chose one over the other. And we believe that that is impermissible at this stage in the proceedings. Now, this is a complex $12 billion corporate deal, a creation of an entertainment joint venture where both sides were contributing a bundle of assets. It evolved out of 2 weeks of frantic negotiations between Thanksgiving of 2001 and mid-December when the contract was signed. The closing came about in May of 2002, and it wasn't until months after the closing that this dispute over tax distributions and whether or not the contract required tax distributions on the preferred interest arose. Now, I want to make something clear based on particularly the argument the last time we were here. It is not Vivendi's position that what USA is saying or their interpretation is somehow unconscionable. What we're saying is different. What we're saying is that if you look at the structure of the deal, it makes no economic sense for us to have agreed when you had very specific delineation as to what the rights of the preferred were in the agreement, that somehow, without any mention of it in the contract, we would have agreed to another $1 billion on top of what we did agree to, the specific delineated rights with regard to the preferred interest. We argued below...
Excuse me, Mr. Quinn, where in the record did those numbers come from?
In terms of the dollar amount?
Yes.
If you compute up the amounts that would be paid over the course of the over the course of the 20-year deal, it would come out to, I believe it's $1.3 billion, assuming the tax rate, the current tax rate.
And where in the record do you get support that would enable you to make that computation?
What we pled is, and whether or not the number would be $1.3 billion or $1 billion, what we pled is the number, whatever it is, and based on the current tax rates, it would be in the neighborhood of $1.3 billion. That was not what the parties agreed. The parties only agreed to pay on the common, but not on the preferred.
Are you saying that the number or the...
That specific number is not in the record, Your Honor.
All right.
That's a computation that we did in order to illustrate what the issue is. Whether or not your honors were to find the contract to be ambiguous or whether there was a mistake, we believe that we're entitled to reversal and we're entitled to have discovery as to what the parties actually intended and what the parties actually agreed. The fundamental error that the Vice Chancellor did, in his opinion, was to engage in premature fact-finding. Essentially, the Court of Chancery effectively resolved the core disputed issue, i.e., whether the parties intended for the partnership agreement to provide tax distributions on the preferred interest. We have set forth, and I believe we had a little booklet that we handed up, and under tab A, we've set forth several of the areas where we believe the Vice Chancellor engaged in impermissible fact-finding. First of all, the Court concluded that there was no specific prior agreement with regard to the preferred, where we believe we properly pled that there was a specific prior agreement. The specific prior agreement, as said, was that we agreed to pay on common, we did not agree to pay on preferred. Secondly, the Court decided that the timing of a particular conversation between Mr. Hanizel and Mr. Kaufman was critical to its determination, even though the timing is still a matter of dispute in the record. And more importantly, even though the exact time that that conversation took place really has nothing to do with the ultimate issue in the case. And what I mean by that, as Your Honor will recall, and I believe it was Justice Berger who pointed this out last time, the agreement, the 802 provision, about which has been so much discussion, and about which the respondents here rely on the history of its negotiations, the sole change that was ever made in 802 related to whether or not it was going to be mandatory or whether or not it was going to be discretionary. There was nothing in that exchange of documents that related one way or the other as to whether or not it applied to common or preferred. In other words, changing the word shall to must did not change who is supposed to get the distributions and why. And that, we believe, is critical in this case. That conversation, the fact that a demand was made at some time by the respondents, USA, and that it is unequivocal and it's agreed in the record that that demand was, in fact, rejected, that you can fairly infer from that, certainly one inference of that, is that the parties then went ahead and signed that agreement, agreeing that they were only going to get tax distributions on the common. And that's what we believe, exactly what happened here, and that's why we believe we're entitled to have discovery. We're entitled to go into the parole evidence. We're entitled to determine from the negotiators what was said, what was understood. Based on the pleadings as they exist today, that simply cannot be determined. Now, let me focus for a moment on the issue of ambiguity. We've pointed out in our briefs that if you look at this critical provision, 802, and look at the other provision that it refers to, there is an inherent ambiguity in those provisions. The ambiguity is that in 802, it talks about making the cash tax distributions in accordance with the taxable income as allocated under 702. Unfortunately, 702 does not allocate taxable income. It allocates net income. Net income is something that is a defined defined term, and it is completely different from, and indeed, again, going outside the record, we made a computation to determine whether or not net income, how different net income was to taxable income for a given year. And in 2003, the difference is almost $200 million. That difference cannot be explained by the interplay between 802 and 702. Indeed, taxable income is actually allocated not under 702, but under a different provision, 703. That is a plain ambiguity on its face, and one that cannot be explained by the document itself. But when you add to that ambiguity the fact that yet another provision, Section 501, which is the provision that actually talks about cash preferences and distributions under the preferred, mentions several different provisions where there is a preference with regard to the deferred. It mentions Section 806, it mentions Section 1302, it mentions Section 801A. All of these are specifically set forth in Section 501, which is in the agreement to actually define what the preferred preferences are, what the distributions are, and yet 501 does not mention any tax distribution pursuant to 802, even though the amount of money involved would be larger than any of the other distributions. We believe, when you look at this together, the incongruity between 802 and 702, the fact that nothing explains in the agreement itself why 501 does not reference 802, all of that taken together makes this agreement ambiguous and should allow us to go into parole evidence, to have some discovery, and let me make something clear. We're not looking, we don't think the sky is falling, we're not looking to open up a mass amount of discovery. What we're asking is simply to take targeted discovery, let's talk to the negotiators, let's see what documents got exchanged, let's make some determination as to what actually happened here, given the ambiguity that's inherent in this document. Once again, we don't believe that you can simply, at this stage of the pleading, choose between two reasonable alternatives. You have to have some discovery. Now, this disconnect between 802 and 702, and 501 for that matter, cannot be explained, as counsel last time suggested, by looking at the definitional section of the agreement, which is paragraph 101. The reason for that is 101 itself never even mentions 802, although it does mention 702. Nowhere is the disconnect between the fact that taxable income is actually distributed pursuant to 703 and not 702. It's explained by referencing section 101, which is simply a definitional section. And nowhere does the difference between the amount of taxable income and net income is reconciled by looking at section 101. The reality is that while counsel has suggested that somehow taxable income is a subset of net income that you can just simply compute out, that is not the case. They are totally different concepts. Net income has to do with book value. Taxable income has to do with tax basis. They're different numbers, and you can't unpack one from the other, particularly in the situation here where all of the property that was contributed was property that actually had a different tax base than it had in terms of fair market value. Now, I mentioned this briefly before, but let me focus on it once again. Interactive has argued with some vociferousness that 802, according to Vice Chancellor, is clear as day, and that there were, it was extensively drafted, it was extensively negotiated. The problem with that is that it misses the point in terms of what's before the court today. It has nothing to do with, those negotiations had nothing to do with the common versus preferred issue. It's solely related to the mandatory versus discretionary issue, and it does not, those negotiations do not explain the disconnect between the language of 802 and the language of 702, or the fact that 501 does not mention the tax distributions on the preferred. This is precisely why we believe we need to have discovery on this issue.
to determine what happened. The contract simply does not reflect the party's intent or their prior actual agreement. And there are cases that several of you have written, I'm sure you're aware of them, like the Saber case or the Vanderbilt case, which say that if under any reasonable set of facts, the non-movement can succeed, then you should not throw the case out at the pleading stage. And I believe it's the Vanderbilt case, the ruling was that you could only dismiss if there's only one single reasonable interpretation. And we believe that if you look at the pleadings here, you clearly will come away with the fact that there's at least two, if not more, reasonable interpretations of what happened here, which is precisely why we need to have what the parole evidence is. We have to go outside the contract and take some discovery. Let me focus for a few minutes on the issue of mistake. Because even if you were to find, as I don't think you should, that the contract is unambiguous, roads nevertheless lead back to the issue of mistake. Mistake in the drafting of the contract. Again, this is where we believe the Vice Chancellor made erroneous findings of fact. Basically, the Vice Chancellor said, well, we never really pleaded as required in Cerberus that there was a specific prior agreement. And in one of the tabs that we handed up, we set forth where, in fact, there was an agreement. We gave examples of what the pleading was. And it was clear, if you look at those pleadings, they may be short or terse, but they're clear, that the agreement that we were pleading was we agreed with regard to common, we never agreed with regard to preferred. And the agreement was common only. Indeed, when you look at the papers that USA Interactive filed, in any number of places, which is under tab D, they fully understood the specific prior agreement that we had pled. Common only, not preferred. And that agreement, we believe, can be inferred in the pleadings from the conversation between Mr. Hanazo and Mr. Kaufman, which, in fact, is not disputed. They made the demand. We said no. They went forward with the agreement. We believe a fair inference of that conversation is that the parties agreed that it would only be on common. They understood it would not be on preferred.
Mr. Quinn, in
yes.
This case, we were very familiar with a record $50. Are you aware of any document that would explicitly support your side's position that the distribution fees would be on common only?
Am I currently aware of it?
Right.
I am not personally aware of such documents, but we believe that if we're allowed to have discovery, we will find such documents from the other side. One is left to wonder a little bit about what are they afraid of, having a little bit of discovery. We're not really asking to open the floodgates here. This is very focused in terms of what the discussions were. Were there any drafts? What went back and forth? Were there internal memos? We believe that we will be able to show that it was the party's understanding that there would be only tax distributions on the common, Your Honor.
If there are such documents, I understand you to be saying that they would be in the other side's file, not your side.
We have some documents that would tend to support what we're saying, but a lot of this, as I said, this whole thing happened in 2 weeks. And it was very, I think a lot of what happened in oral conversation between the parties, the key negotiators, which is why I think it's so critical to take the depositions of the people who actually were having these discussions and understood what their takeaway was when they had these discussions. Because, again, it's not disputed that there was a discussion where we turned down the demand. The critical issue, I think, in Cerberus, and I think that we've met it here, is, I think Justice Vesey wrote, is there enough for the court to be able to reform a contract to reflect the party's true intent? And here, we believe, given the pleading, and given the understanding of both sides with regard to what we say the agreement was, there is plainly enough under that test for the court to
to reform the contract to make it clear, if it's not clear, that we only agreed with regard to common and specifically did not agree with regard to the preferred. To say, as the respondents that did below, that this was nothing more than a pleading of prior disagreement is simply not the case. If you read the pleadings in their entirety, you will see that what we were pleading was that there was an agreement that we would pay on common and not on the preferred. And again, the key issue to be explored relates to these negotiations, these discussions, particularly between Mr. Hanazo and Mr. Kaufman. And we believe we will be able to show not only the inference that currently exists in the pleading, that is, that they went forward with the agreement, signed the agreement, knowing that they had not agreed that we were not going to pay on preferred. One question that I think that, as I've been thinking about this over the last few days, that strikes me as interesting when we look at this. We have the other side saying, and Vice Chancellor Lamb saying, that this is, that 802 was clear as day. Clear as day. Well, if that were the case, given the fact that 802 never changed in terms of the language, other than with regard to mandatory versus discretionary, why did they come to us and ask for preferred, tax distributions on preferred? Under their theory of the case, they had it already. And I suggest to you that the only thing you can infer from that is that they knew they didn't have it, and they were still trying to get it. And that's precisely the issue that we need to explore.
Gwen, did you want to save 5 minutes for rebuttal?
I did. Are we there?
We are.
I'm saving them. Thanks, Jeff. Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. Paul Rowe
for USA Interactive, now IAC. Your Honors, on this appeal, the issue is the potential reversal of two carefully reasoned rulings by Vice Chancellor Lamb. We believe he correctly construed a contract which he found to be, quote, clear as day and unambiguous. We also believe he correctly applied this court's Cerberus holding as to the nature of the elements of the law of reformation of contracts for mistake. We do not believe that Vivendi should be able to get over these carefully reasoned rulings and obtain a reversal based on what essentially are advocates' claims of what the evidence will show if discovery is permitted.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Of course, Your Honor.
How do you respond to one of the final points of opposing counsel, which is that this Section 8.02, although it was modified and different drafts were drawn up, none of the different drafts addressed preferred versus common. And that was specifically requested and turned down. So why shouldn't the inference be made that it must be ambiguous if you asked for it and then no change has been made in the language, and now you're both taking opposite views as to what's in there and what isn't?
Your Honor, I think that question puts in a nutshell what we think is the essence of Cerberus and puts the finger on the very place where we think Vivendi is misinterpreting the law. It is not enough under Cerberus and the law of reformation for mistake.
I'm not talking about mistake. I'm talking about ambiguity.
Your Honor, there's nothing ambiguous about the terms of the contract itself. The terms of the contract itself, as the Vice Chancellor found, have a mandatory, the way the contract was signed, it has a mandatory command in Section 802 to provide tax distributions which are calculated by applying the then current tax rate to income allocations that are made under Section 702.
Okay, but wait. I may have misunderstood, but let me clarify it at least for my own sake. My understanding of opposing counsel's argument was during the drafting stage, your client asked for both preferred and common distribution, tax distribution. You were told no, that was not acceptable. And when you asked the same language was in the contract as it was when you finally signed it, at least in terms of this particular issue. So doesn't that by itself tend to show that it was ambiguous? Otherwise, why did you have to ask to have it put in the contract?
Your Honor, I think that the summary of the pleadings concerning those conversations are not quite as Your Honor recollects them or has just stated them. What was pleaded here and what was conceded by Vivendi's counsel below and what is discussed in footnote 85 of Vice Chancellor Lamb's opinion is the fact that when the first draft was circulated, it was essentially a we'll pay you tax distributions if we feel like it language. Now, those tax distributions, because I think this is an important point, were always tied to Section 702. Section 702 always had a reference to the preferred. So there was never any question but that if tax distributions were going to be mandatory, they were going to be paid on the preferred. The issue was, were they going to be mandatory or were they going to be at Vivendi's discretion? But all the parties knew that if they were going to be paid, they were going to be paid on the preferred because Section 702 in 702A1B expressly provides for allocations to the preferred.
I understand that. So perhaps I've misunderstood what opposing counsel said, but I thought that your client asked for distribution on the preferred, and we're told, no, you're not getting distribution on the preferred.
We asked for mandatory tax distributions on the income to be allocated.
So you never asked for a distribution on the preferred, you just asked that it be mandatory as opposed to optional.
The preferred was always included, Your Honor.
Mr. Ray, let me suggest to you that it's probable that I heard the very same thing that Justice Berger did. In fact, I wrote it down. The representation I heard was it is, quote, not disputed that there were discussions where demand for the preferred to be treated as common was turned down. Now, both on the issue of whether the contract's ambiguous or not, and on the issue of whether there was an earlier agreement, it seems to me that assertion that it's not disputed is very relevant. Is it correct that it was not disputed? Because it suggested, at least to me on the prior agreement argument, that you had reached an agreement because you asked for preferred to be treated as common, not mandatory versus discretion, and you were turned down, and we're asked logically to infer from that that then there must have been an earlier agreement that the preferred were not to be treated as common, and the contract just got it wrong. That's what I heard. Maybe two out of five of us misheard, which is not good odds.
Your Honor, the fact there is some confusion here because we don't have the drafts in front of us. The original draft did not provide for distributions on either preferred or common to be mandatory. We then asked for preferred and common distributions to be mandatory, and we got back a marked-up draft that conceded the point. It conceded that they would be mandatory. It therefore applied to the preferred and the common. The dispute was a disagreement, and this is relevant on the mistake point. There was simply a disagreement when during the only oral conversation. There, both sides agree. There's an agreement in the pleadings, and there was a concession below that there's essentially one conversation here between our Mr. Kaufman and their Mr. Anizel. And that is a discussion in which Mr. Kaufman asks for this, and Mr. Anizel says, no. They say that that is enough to create an ambiguity, and they say it's enough to create a basis for a mistake pleading. We say it's not enough to create a basis for ambiguity because you don't go to extrinsic evidence such as the parties' conversations. You don't go outside the four corners of the document to parallel evidence like that if, in fact, the document on its face is clear and unambiguous. And I submit that Vice Chancellor Lamb was totally right when he said that when you read 802 and 702 together, they function as a formula. So the real issue this is relevant to is mistake. And Mr. Quinn has said, he said in words of one syllable, that all you need to get to a mistake pleading to get to the discovery stage is essentially two things. You need to have pleaded that there was a dispute and a disagreement, and you need to have put the court and the other party on notice as to how you would like the contract reformed, what the new term ought to be. And he's basically saying there's never been any dispute, but that we understood that they think the contract should say that the tax distributions only apply to the common. This just misunderstands the law of mistake as set forth in Cerberus. Cerberus says there has to be a specific prior agreement. Why is that? Because if there is no specific prior agreement, the court is imposing a contract on parties that never made a contract. They had a disagreement as to the term in a contract, and that disagreement cannot be remedied by the court saying, all right, I'm going to impose your term. People in that position, where they're essentially saying we had a disagreement, there's been no meeting of the minds, people in that position have a potential remedy, and it's called rescission. And if you ask for rescission, as they have not, you have to meet various other requirements, and essentially you have to be willing to undo the transaction, which they're not willing to do. But if you want reformation for mistake, what Cerberus says is you have to allege a prior specific meeting of the minds. And I think you heard very clearly from Mr. Quinn that there was no meeting of the minds in this conversation. What there was a disagreement. And that's exactly what Vice Chancellor Lamb found, and we believe he was correct.
Well, as a big fan of words of one syllable, bear with me for a minute. If I understand correctly what the other side argued, they're arguing that there was, in fact, a prior agreement simply from a conversation in which one party said to the other, we want the preferred to be treated the same as the common. The other party said, no, they will not be. We will not agree to that. Then a contract is drafted that's ambiguous in terms of whether it's perfectly clear that preferred will not be treated the same as the common. And that is what they allege to be the prior agreement. It's not simply that there was a dispute. It was resolved when the answer no, a word of one syllable, came back to the other party. Now, is that inconsistent with service?
Well, if it were the case that the contract was indeed ambiguous as to whether or not 802 picked up the preferred, there might be something to that.
But well, let's assume for the sake of argument that someone believes the contract's ambiguous, and we go to the second issue, which is whether or not there has been a genuine mistake here that will result in reformation. Would that fact scenario, if not disputed, as Mr. Quinn asserted, would that be sufficient to satisfy the service test for a prior agreement?
Well, it would not satisfy the Cerberus test, because under Cerberus, you have to plead that there was, in fact, an agreement prior to the writing. In other words, it is essential to the law of mistake that the parties accept that the contract was signed embodies a mistake, that it embodies something other than what the parties agreed to. What is being conflated here is the notion that the contract, in fact, expresses what they say it expresses, with the notion that they can also sue for mistake. You cannot. When you sue for mistake, you are admitting that the contract says what the other party says it says.
Okay.
Now,
let me just follow up on one point, Mr. Rowe. Your side's position is that there has to be a prior agreement before the executed document is an issue. The response is there is a prior agreement, and that agreement is distributions of common but not preferred. Your response is, well, that may be your theory, but that is not an inference that is permissible from these pleadings because there has to be something more specific. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, and what is it exactly that is required, according to your side, that's not there?
Well, Your Honor, you can't just say, in our view, that there was an agreement. You have to plead what the agreement was, and in some sense, you have to give the court a pleadings basis to infer that it occurred. If there had been a pleading here that there was a second conversation, in which Mr. Kaufman said, you know, we had that conversation about the preferred, and we now agree with you, that would be sufficient. For example, in Cerberus, there was a notation, this is fine. There was some evidence that, in fact, there had been an agreement, and that was pleaded. If there had been a second conversation, if there had ever been a meeting of the minds here between the two parties, it would have been pleaded in their counterclaims.
So the distinction you're drawing is between a legal conclusion and factual specificity in the complaint. And you're saying that because there is no factual specificity, then the legal conclusion, that is the agreement, that there would be distributions only in the common, is something that we cannot take cognizance of.
Exactly, Your Honor, because if you accept what I call the conclusory theory, where you can just allege that there was an agreement, then this whole notion that the law of mistake requires a prior specific agreement is swallowed up in the exception. Because all a party has to do, all somebody who is unhappy with the bargain they made has to do, is come into court and say, I asked for that, I understand I didn't get it, and I understand the contract doesn't give it to me, but I really felt sincerely that I was getting it. And I've told you what it is I think I'm getting, so there's no uncertainty about it. So let's have discovery. Let's go through discovery. Let's have a contract not be a contract. And the essence of the Cerberus rule, and it's not a rule that's unique to this state, you can find it in Williston and Corbin and all the contract treatises, is that you can't, mistake is an exception to the general rule that when a contract is clear on its face, you cannot go beyond the contract and open up everything for discovery unless you can plead something very important and specific, which is that there was a meeting of the minds. Not that one party just understood the contract or the ultimate agreement differently.
Mr. Miller, help us understand how this fits into the notice pleading concept. Some things you give notice, others you have to plead with particularity. I guess you could be saying either that you don't have adequate notice, or are you saying that this is something that should have been pled more particularly?
Well, it's not just a question of a sort of Rule 9b particularity issue. We think the problem here is they have not even properly alleged one of the substantive elements of the cause of action. A substantive element of a cause of action for reformation for mistake under Cerberus is the allegation of a prior specific agreement. The word specific occurs in Cerberus at 794 A second at 1151-52. Now, if it were simply a notice pleading concept, you would have the problem that I identified a moment ago, which is that all a remorseful buyer or seller would have to do to be able to take advantage of the mistake doctrine would be to say, here's what I thought I was agreeing to. They wouldn't have to say, and I had a conversation with so-and-so, or I saw a notation on the side of the draft. They wouldn't have to supply anything that gave even the slightest scintilla of support to the notion that there was a prior meeting of the minds. Because that's what you need. If you don't have a meeting of the minds, your remedy is rescission. If you do have a meeting of the minds, you can sue for mistake, but you have to allege with specificity under Cerberus that there was this specific agreement. Now, Your Honor, I'd like to address a couple of the other comments that were made by opposing counsel. We do not believe that the court below engaged in any impermissible resolutions of disputed factual issues. If you look at the pleading that was made concerning all these issues, particularly mistake, you will find that their pleading is extremely thin. As the court below found, it essentially consists of one paragraph. And so what happened in the briefing and the argument below was Vivendi went looking in the documents that had been incorporated by reference in both sides' pleadings, such as the proxy statement and the transcript of the analyst call and so forth. They went looking in those documents for snippets of things that they said would have given someone the opportunity to make an inference in their favor. And if you treat any resolution of an argument like that as the resolution of a factual issue, again, you're basically saying that there is no pleading gatekeeper stage function for mistake cases, because someone is always going to be able to present in their pleadings an unreasonable interpretation of an excerpt from a lengthy document like a proxy statement. And so what Vice Chancellor Lamb did, which we submit was entirely appropriate, was he looked at the face of the document. For example, in the proxy statement, there's a reference to the value of the securities, and there was an argument below as to whether or not that was pre-tax or post-tax. And so he looked at it, and he saw that on the face of that document, it said that if Allen and Company had valued this security on an after-tax effective basis, it would have had a higher value. So on the basis of that, he said, I can only draw one inference from this. So he did not engage in any kind of fact-finding. He simply did what judges on pleadings motions do all the time in this state, which is they accept as allegations only well-pleaded allegations, and they do not, under Grobo versus Perot and Loudon versus Archer Daniels Midland and other cases you're familiar with, they do not accept, and indeed they reject, unreasonable inferences.
So you're saying in conceptual terms that what the Vice Chancellor did was to refuse to accept as legitimate inferences the inferences that the other side seeks to draw, rather than accepting the inferences and then resolving the fact issue against the other side.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Mr. Quinn said that there were multiple reasonable interpretations. Well, it's exactly that point that is addressed by the ability of the Court of Chancery to pierce the pleadings and determine whether an allegation is well pleaded or whether the party is seeking an unreasonable inference. Now, to turn for a moment to the argument that Mr. Quinn made and was made below about the supposed ambiguity arising out of the use of the term taxable income in Section 802 and the defined term net income in Section 702. One point we made in our brief, and I won't belabor here, we spend three pages on it, on pages 16 to 18 of our brief, is that that argument was not only not raised below, but it was in fact contradicted by the argument below. And I'd make the same point to the extent we get into it about this issue of the timing of the Kaufman-Anizot conversation. Mr. Quinn, at the last argument, passed over this very quickly, but in fact, in footnote 85 of his opinion, Vice Chancellor Lamb points out not one, not two, but three places where in the argument below, counsel for Vivendi in fact conceded exactly what we say they are stuck with as their position, which is that in fact the conversation, the only logical time for the conversation to have occurred was right after the first draft on December 6th, and that was in fact conceded by Mr. Warren, who argued below. I believe that's at pages appendix A655 to 656, and I'll just briefly read you the exchange. Mr. Warren, or rather the court, was that ever communicated? Mr. Warren, yes. The court, where? Mr. Warren, that's when Mr. Anizot says in response, both sides have the first draft. Mr. Kaufman goes, and according to the Vivendi pleading, Mr. Kaufman goes and says, both sides have this draft, and he says, I would like a tax gross-up on the preferred, and Mr. Anizot says no. So that's how they argued it below. That's what they told Vice Chancellor Lamb their position was, and now they're seeking to create uncertainty in this court based on a different position. But to return to a second to this taxable income versus net income issue, because again, it's not something they raised below. They're trying to take advantage of the fact that it hasn't been dealt with in the court's opinion. But the fact is, the answer is very simple and very clear. Net income is a defined term. It's defined in Section 101. You can find it in the appendix at page A20, period 12. And net income is a defined term that has various components. It uses the word components. One of the components is taxable income with a small t and a small I. And so net income clearly includes taxable income. There is a reason the terms are slightly different, which has to do with tax treatment of built-in gain property. But the issue, again, it's an attempt to create an ambiguity or an aura of ambiguity where absolutely none exists. And I'd like to close, Your Honors, by answering the question that I was presented with, a sort of challenge, which is, what are we afraid of in terms of discovery? And the answer is, we're not afraid of anything in terms of discovery. What we are a contracting party that entered into a complex transaction. We gave this partnership $11.5 billion of assets. They had complete control of these assets for 20 years. We have virtually no economic return on those assets except for this relatively small payment. And it was perfectly reasonable from a business point of view that we would ask for and get a certain amount of cash return on it. And this is a contract which, if it is unambiguous and clear, ought to be enforced. The vendor was advised by the Cravath firm. Our client was advised by our firm. We signed a contract. It's clear. We submit, Your Honors, it ought to be enforced as the Court of Chancery found. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rowe.
Let me just deal with a couple of the issues that counsel raised. One, with regard to this issue that the ambiguity between 802 and 702 wasn't raised below. I'm just going to read from one of our briefs below. As an independent basis to deny the motion, Interactive's erroneous reading of sections 802 and 702 renders the partnership agreement ambiguous and internally inconsistent. That was before the court below. The court dealt with that issue and dealt with it against us, but it was clearly raised below. To the extent we're focusing on this specific taxable versus net income, that's simply a refinement of the argument that we made below. And this court has repeatedly said, in the Watkin case, for example, among others, that when you're not raising a new theory but just a new reason why you should win, that's perfectly permissible. Let me focus for a moment on the issue relating to mistake, and then I'll go back to ambiguity. In Cerberus, the court was saying that if it's clear, you have to show a specific prior agreement. But it didn't have to be written. It said it could be oral. It didn't even have to be complete. It simply had to be a meeting of the minds. We are saying there was a meeting of the minds. That's what we pled. If you read the pleadings in their entirety, that's what we pled. The meeting of the minds was common, not preferred, all in one group. It's not a disagreement. It was a meeting of the minds. And we believe we should be entitled to show that through discovery.
Do you see anything to the suggestion that the timing of the first draft is critical to whether the prior agreement is truly prior?
The answer is no, for the reasons I said before. Whether or not it happened on December 6th, 7th, 8th, 5th, 4th, the reality is that Mr. Kaufman trundled up to Mr. Hanazo at some point and said, we want it on the preferred. They've now admitted that, Your Honor. They said it's agreed. Kaufman asked, Hanazo says no. When that happened is irrelevant since the language of 802 never changed. And that's the critical fact here. The fact is that anyone looking at those set of facts can walk away and say, a fair inference of that is that Kaufman knew full well he didn't get preferred. And whether or not the agreement then was a unilateral mistake, that he allowed the language to go forward
and be unclear and then spring it on us months later, which is what actually happened here. Remember, you have other facts that have been pled. You have the analyst meeting where we believe, if you look at what he said, you can infer that at least either he agreed preferred wasn't involved or he was hiding in the weeds until he could later spring it on us, because he referred only to the $60 million when, if you compute what the numbers would be, it would have been $120 million. We set that forth in our brief. Similarly, with regard to the proxy statement, we believe, if you look at the proxy statement, and what the vice chancellor did below was look at the proxy statement, and notwithstanding what Mr. Rowe said, the vice chancellor actually looked at the proxy statement, he looked at letters to the SEC that we had nothing to do with, and he construed those. He went outside the record, construed them, and he construed them against us. Impermissible to do on judgment on the pleadings. Mr. Rowe said this kind of thing is done all the time. In fairness, I've been unfortunately around maybe too long now. I've never seen a judgment on the pleadings. I've never heard of a judgment on the pleadings that awards one side over $1 billion. It's not done all the time. It's unprecedented. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.